His finger was on the trigger, and even though it was a puny weapon with which to take on a Kalashnikov, he was ready to return fire. He picked up his target immediately and swung onto it. There was a man crouched 20 paces away, the assault rifle he carried aimed into Nicholas's face. He was black, dressed in worn and tattered camouflage fatigues and a soft cap of the same material. His webbing held a bush knife and grenades, water bottle and all the other accoutrements of guerrilla fighting. Schufter, thought Nicholas. A real pro. Don't take chances with this one. Yet at the same time he realized that if the intention had been to kill him, then he would be dead already. He aimed the Rigby an inch over the muzzle of the assault rifle into the bloodshot right eye of the Schufter behind it. The man acknowledged the standoff with a narrowing of his eyes and then gave an order in Arabic. Salim, cover the woman. Shoot them if he moves. Nicholas heard movement on his flank and glanced in that direction, still keeping the Schufter in his peripheral vision. Another guerrilla stepped out of the scrub. He was similarly dressed, but he carried a Soviet RPD light machine gun on his hip. The barrel was sawn off short to make the weapon more handy for bushfighting, and there was a loop of ammunition belt draped around his neck. He came forward carefully, the RPD aimed point blank at the two women. Nicholas knew that with a touch on the trigger he could chop them both to mincemeat. There were other stealthy, rustling sounds in the bush all around them. These two were not the only ones, Nicholas realized. This was a large war party. He might be able to get off one shot with the Rigby, but by then Royan and Tessé would be dead, and he would not be far behind them. Very slowly and deliberately, he lowered the muzzle of the rifle until it was pointing at the ground. Then he laid the weapon down and raised his hands. "Get your hands up," he told the women. "Do exactly what they tell you to." The guerrilla leader acknowledged his surrender by coming to his full height and speaking rapidly to his men, still in Arabic. "Get the rifle and his pack." "We are British subjects," Nicholas told him loudly, and the guerrilla looked surprised by his use of Arabic. "We are simple tourists. We are not military. We are not government people." "Be quiet. Shut your face," he ordered, as the rest of the guerrilla patrol emerged from cover. Nicholas counted 5 of them, all told, though he knew there were probably others who had not come forward. They were very professional as they rounded up their prisoners. They never blocked each other's field of fire, nor offered an opportunity of escape. Quickly they searched them for weapons, then closed in around them and hustled them onto the path. "Where are you taking us?" Nicholas demanded. "No questions." The butt of an AK-47 smashed between his shoulder blades and almost knocked him off his feet. "Steady on, chaps," he murmured mildly in English. "That wasn't really called for." They were forced to keep marching through the heat of the afternoon. Nicholas kept a check on the position of the sun and the distant glimpses of the escarpment wall. He realized that they were heading westwards, following the course of the Nile towards the Sudanese border. It was late afternoon, and Nicholas estimated that they had covered some 10 miles before they came upon a side shoot of the main valley. The slopes were heavily wooded, and the three prisoners were herded into a patch of this forest. They were actually within the perimeter of the guerrilla camp before they were aware of its existence. Cunningly camouflaged, it consisted merely of a few crude lean-to shelters and a ring of weapons emplacements. The sentries were well placed, and all the light machine guns in the foxholes were manned. They were led to one of the shelters in the centre of the camp, where three men were squatting around a map spread on a low camp table. These were obviously officers, and there was no mistaking which of the three was the commander. The leader of the patrol, which had captured them, went to this man, saluted him deferentially, and then spoke to him urgently, pointing at his captives. The guerrilla commander straightened up from the table and came out into the sunlight. He was of medium height, but was imbued with such an air of authority that he seemed taller. His shoulders were broad and his body square and chunky, with the beginning of a dignified spread around the waist. He wore a short curly beard which contained a few strands of grey, and his features were refined and handsome. His skin tones were amber and copper. His dark eyes were intelligent, his gaze quick and restless. "My men tell me that you speak Arabic," he said to Nicholas. "Better than you do, McNamara," Nicholas told him. "So now you are the leader of a bunch of bandits and kidnappers. I always told you that you would never get to heaven, you old reprobate." McNamara stared at him in astonishment, and then began to smile. "Nicholas, I did not recognize you. You are older. Look at the grey on your head." He opened his arms wide and folded Nicholas into a bear hug. "Nicholas, Nicholas!" He kissed him once on each cheek. Then he held him at arm's length and looked at the two women, who were standing amazed. "He saved my life," he explained to them. "Oh, you make me blush, Mech." Mech kissed him again. "He saved my life twice." "Once," Nicholas contradicted him. "The second time was a mistake. I should have let them shoot you." Mech laughed delightedly. "How long ago was it, Nicholas?" "Oh, it doesn't bear thinking about." 15 years at least," Mech said. "Are you still in the British Army? What is your rank? You must be a general by now." No, reserves only." Nicholas shook his head. "I've been back in Civvy Street a long time now." Still hugging Nicholas, McNamara looked at the women with interest. "Nicholas taught me most of what I know about soldiering," he told them. His eyes flicked from Royan to Tessé, and then stayed on the Ethiopian girl's dark and lovely face. "I know you," he said. "I saw you in Addis years ago. You were a young girl then. Your father was Alto Zaman, a great and good man. He was murdered by the tyrant Mengistu." "I know you also, Alto Mech. My father held you in high esteem. There are many of us who believe that you should be the president of this Ethiopia of ours, in place of that other one." She dropped him a graceful little curtsy, hanging her head in a shy but appealing gesture of respect. "I am flattered by your opinion of me." He took her hand and lifted her to her full height. Then he turned back to Nicholas. "I am sorry for the rough welcome. Some of my men are over-enthusiastic. I knew that there were Ferengi asking questions at the monastery. But enough. You are with friends here. I bid you welcome." McNamara led them to his shelter, where one of his men brought a soot-blackened kettle from the fire and poured viscous black coffee into mugs for them. He and Nicholas plunged into reminiscences of the days prior to the Falklands War, when they had fought side by side, Nicholas as a covert military adviser and Mech as a young freedom fighter opposing the tyranny of Mengistu. "But the war is over now, Mech," Nicholas remonstrated at last. "The battle is won. Why are you still out in the bush with your men? Why aren't you getting rich and fat in Addis like all the others?" "In the interim government in Addis there are enemies of mine, men like Mengistu. When we have got rid of them, then I will come out of the bush." He and Nicholas embarked into a spirited discussion of African politics, so deep and complicated that Royan knew very few of the personalities whom they were discussing, nor could she follow the nuances and the subtlety of religious and tribal prejudices and intolerance that had persisted for 1,000 years. She was, however, impressed by Nicholas's knowledge and understanding of the situation, and the way in which a man like McNamara asked his opinion and listened to his advice. In the end, Nicholas asked him, "So now you have carried the war beyond the borders of Ethiopia itself. You are operating in Sudan as well?" "The war in the Sudan has been raging for 20 years, Mech confirmed. "The Christians in the south fighting against the persecution of the Muslim north." "I am well aware of that, Mech, but that is not Ethiopia. It is not your war." "They are Christians, and they suffer injustice. I am a soldier and a Christian. Of course it is my war." Tessé had been listening avidly to every word that Mech spoke, and now she nodded her head in agreement, her eyes dark and solemn with hero worship. "Alto Mech is a crusader for Christ and the rights of the common man," Tessé told Nicholas in awed tones. And he dearly loves a good fight, Nicholas laughed, punching his shoulder affectionately. It was a familiar gesture which could easily have given offence, but Mac accepted it readily and laughed back at him. What are you doing here yourself, Nicholas, if you are no longer a soldier? There was a time when you also loved a good fight. Oh, I am completely reformed. No more fighting. I have come to the Abbey Gorge to hunt Dick Dick. Dick Dick? Mac Nimmer stared at him with disbelief, and then he roared with laughter. Oh, I don't believe it. Not you. Not Dick Dick. Aye, you are up to something. It is the truth. Ah, you are lying, Nicholas. You never could lie to me. I know you too well. You are up to something. You will tell me about it when you need my help. And you will still give me your help? Of course. You saved my life twice. Once, said Nicholas. Even once is enough, said Mac Nimmer. While they talked, the sun slanted down the sky. You are my guests for tonight, Mac Nimmer told them formally. In the morning I will escort you back to your camp at the monastery of St. Frumentius. That is also my destination. My men and I are going to the monastery to celebrate the festival of Timkat. The abbot, Jali Hora, is a friend and an ally. And the monastery is probably your deep cover base. You use it and the monks for resupply and intelligence, am I right? You know me too well, Nicholas. Mac Nimmer shook his head ruefully. You taught me much of what I know, so why should you not be able to guess my strategy? The monastery makes a perfect base of operations. It's close enough to the border. He broke off, smiling. But there's no need to explain it to you, of all people. Mac had his men build a night shelter for Nicholas and Rayan, and cut a mattress of grass to cushion their sleep. They lay close together under the flimsy roof. The night was sultry, and they did not miss their blankets. Nicholas had a tube of insect repellent in his pack to keep the mosquitoes at bay. After they had settled down on the grass mattress, their heads were close enough together to allow them to converse in quiet tones. When he turned his head, Nicholas could see the dark silhouettes of Mac Nimmer and Tessé still sitting close together by the fire. Ethiopian girls are different from the Arabs, and from most other African women. Royan, too, was watching the other couple. No Arab girl would dare be alone with a man like that, especially if she were a married woman. Any way you cut it, they make a damned fine pair, he gave his opinion. Good luck to them. Tessé hasn't had much of that lately. She's overdue. He turned his head and looked into her face. What about you, Royan? What are you? Are you a decorous, submissive Arab, or an independent, assertive Western girl? It's both a little early, much too late for intimate questions of that nature, she told him, and turned over, presenting him with her back. Ah, we are standing on ceremony this evening. Good night, Wazir Royan. Good night, Alter Nicholas, she replied, keeping her face turned away from him, so that he could not see her smile.